Hello, everyone. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, depending on where you might be in the world. Welcome to our online event entitled The Raging 2020s, Companies, Countries, People, and the Fight for Our Future, an event hosted by the School of Public Policy. My name is Andres Velasco. I'm the Dean of the school, and I'm very, very happy and honored on behalf of the school to be welcoming my dear friend and author of the book by the same title, Alec Ross. Welcome, Alec, to the LSE and to the School of Public Policy.
Thank you for having me. Before we jump
into the event, let me just do a little housekeeping here. If you're using Twitter, the hashtag is LSE Alec Ross. Alec with a C, not with an X. The Scottish version, not the English version of the name. The event is being recorded. It will be turned into a podcast. So if you have friends who didn't have the chance to log on live, tell them to look for the podcast and they can get the substance of today's conversation. So, of course, The Raging 2020s is the title of a book, as I mentioned already. And we're going to give Alec in a minute the chance to take the floor, tell us a little bit about the book, what the main point, the main ideas, the main thoughts behind the book happen to be. And then we're going to engage in conversation, make it pretty informal, easygoing. I will take my chair's privilege and ask Alec a few questions, and then, of course, open it up to Q&A from the audience. So there is a Q&A function in the bottom of your screen. Please feel free to simply upload your questions, and I will do my best to convey all of the questions or as many questions as time permits to our speaker. So now, before we turn it over to him, let me just introduce Alec Ross to you. Alec is, he's done a bit of everything, but he's actually done a lot of everything. He began his career as a sixth grade teacher in his native Baltimore, Maryland. But he has done lots of very interesting things. You know, when I first came across him a few years back, it was before he was a, because he was a senior advisor at the State Department in Washington at the time when Hillary Clinton was the Secretary of State. And he was working on innovation, how to modernize the practice of diplomacy. And at the same time, of course, advanced the foreign policy interests of the United States. Since then, he has been a distinguished senior fellow at Johns Hopkins in Baltimore, a senior fellow at Columbia SIPA, and more recently, he's been teaching at the University of Bologna Business School, which of course is, as I'm sure you know, the oldest university in the world. I just learned a minute ago, founded in 1088. In addition to that, Alec is a very prolific and best-selling author. Before this book, he was on the New York Times best-selling list with a book called The Industries of the Future. And of course, Alec is also involved in identifying and helping fund innovative firms in a global venture capital firm called Amplo. So as you can see, writer, scholar, teacher, government advisor, public servant, investor, not a small curriculum, and of course, lots of fascinating experiences that I'm sure he will share with us. Okay, enough from me. Let me just remind you that the title of the book is The Raging 2020s, Companies, Countries, People, and the Fight for Our Future. And again, I welcome Alec Ross and his book. Alec, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Andres, and thank you to all of you who are participating in this, either live or in a week or a year, watching on YouTube. It's a real pleasure to be able to do this. I actually spoke at an LSE event. I was just sharing with Andres about a decade ago when I was working for President Obama and for Secretary Clinton. And I've gotten a chance to work with a lot of alumni of the London School of Economics. So I'm really pleased to be a part of this today. So thinking about this book, The Raging 2020s, it really started with a question. And the question was, is the future going to look more like Star Trek or more like Mad Max? Star Trek or Mad Max? And that began an almost 4 or 5 year period of research, of observation. I'm not one of those authors who writes a book every year, 18 months. I'm one that writes a book every 5 years. And so this was really a product of 5 years of reflection and study. And to the question of whether the future is going to look more like Mad Max or more like Star Trek, the central conclusion that I came to is it's an open question. It could go either way. But this decade of ours, the 2020s, has gotten off to a lousy start. It's gotten off to a start with a pandemic in the United States. It's gotten off to a start with a near revolution and with political division, the likes of which has never been seen before and which is growing increasingly violent. And the central conclusion that I came to is that we need to rewrite our social contract. Now, for those of you who haven't studied the social contract in its most basic form, the social contract is the concept that in order for us to coexist in a society, we need to define the responsibilities and the duties and the limits of those responsibilities and duties between the governing and the governed. The social contract has existed ever since humankind has been on 2 feet and people determined that they would be better off banding together, hunting and gathering together than as individuals trying to fend off saber-toothed tigers on their own. So the social contract is this living, unwritten document which defines the relationship between the governing and the governed. And the little different twist that I have in this book, as opposed to people who have written about the social contract in past, whether it's Hobbes or Locke or Rousseau or more recent writers, is that I also believe that now there's an important third actor. There's a sort of third protagonist, which is a business. We live in a world right now where we are increasingly more governed by companies than we are by governments. Facebook is a country. Amazon is a country. Google is a country. Microsoft is a country. And their CEOs tend to actually to have more power than very many presidents and prime ministers. And the terms of services, the minimum wage, so many things that we would historically have looked to government to regulate or to set the rules of the road for are increasingly set by the private sector for both good and ill. And so the idea behind the social contract is that there ought to be some sort of equilibrium between the public sector, the private sector, and citizens. And I fear that at the moment, we've lost that equilibrium right now. The social contract feels like it's been broken. And I think that we're in something that to me reflects a little bit, reminds me a bit of a period called the Engels Pause, which was roughly from the 1790s into the 1840s. And it was during this time that industrialization was accelerating at a very fast pace through much of Western Europe. Labor was increasingly going from farm to factory, from countryside to city, but we did not change the norms of the agricultural age social contract. So if you think about feudalism, for example, the monarch would give rights to the nobility of land ownership and local dominion in exchange for taxes and military service. The serfs were then obliged to live on the land of their lord in exchange for military protection and a percentage of the crops. So this held for centuries in one shape or another, with the church, if anything, playing a role as sort of the third protagonist within this. Well, with industrialization, with another period of transition brought on by technology, it was a difficult transition. And from 1800 to 1840, this was the period of sort of the Charles Dickens novels of industrialization, the caricature of the sort of 11-year-old losing their hand in the factory. And for a period of 40 years, we saw an enormous amount of wealth created, but the wealth accrued in very few hands. And frankly, the amount of rage, for lack of a better word, permeated through the working classes. What was the result of this? Well, the result of this was in part the largest wave of revolutions in Europe's history. Ideological movements like Marxism, the Communist Manifesto was written in 1848. But ultimately, industrialization worked, such as it has, in part because as we innovated technologically, so too did we innovate with our public policy. So, you know, we would say, yes, you can work in our factories, but we're going to create this thing that didn't exist previously called a child labor law. So you can't actually work here until you're 16. The concept of a minimum wage, the concept of a weekend. Weekends didn't actually exist for the most part until the mid-19th century. It was an idea of unions. A pension, work in our factory for 25 or 30 years, and at the end of it, you will get some significant percentage of your final income until you die. The concept of free education until you're about age 18, regardless of what your surname is or what postal code you live in, so that we can spread the benefits of the wealth that came from industrialization. All of these ideas were largely products of the mid-19th century that were then institutionalized in government by people like Lord Asquith, by Bismarck in Germany. And it helped to essentially establish some of the equilibrium that existed between state capital and labor and held for a very long time. But I think now we've entered into a sort of new Engels clause. We've entered into a new period of transition where we're going from having a dominantly industrial-based economy into one that is technology-rich and knowledge-based. And where, you know, I have three children. I have a 14-year-old, a 16-year-old, and a 19-year-old. And I bet that of those three children, it's very, very unlikely that any of them have a single employer for 25 or 30 years from whom they then get a pension on the back end. So what is a pension in the context of 2020s and beyond? The concept behind free education was largely rooted in what the norms were for the early 19th century, when we had a first agricultural-based economy. You would have the summers off in large part so that the children could work the field. And then education ended around age 18 because the assumption was that the elites and the high achievers could then go to university and the non-elites could go to work in the port, factory, mine, or mill. Now we live in a world of necessary lifelong learning, but our educational system is still rooted in the reality of what was true in the 1820s and 1830s. And so this book, again, The Raging 2020s, I promise that's the last time I do that, tries to, not as the voice of God, but tries to draw out a number of topics that I think we need to look at with fresh eyes. Tax, for example. Tax doesn't work as it existed in decades prior with the onset of globalization and with the global nature of capital. Unionization and the labor movement. I'm very, very critical of the labor movement in the UK and in the USA because I don't believe it's evolved past what the world of work looked like in the 1970s. And then looking at things like, what is the role of the private sector in all this for good and ill? So that in a thumbnail is The Raging 2020s. It's trying to think about what are those very powerful forces that are shaping our future and trying to get us to think, as we did 200 years ago with the onset of industrialization, what are the new ideas that we can bring forward that can make the economy as it works today and as we anticipate it'll work for at least the next 10 years and make it work for more people?
Wonderful. What a great introduction. These are all gigantic themes. I am very happy that we have a little time to explore some of these. Let me begin with a question on the role of private enterprise, companies, technology. You know, given the speed of technological innovation, it's natural that you should put it at the center. But there are two issues that come up when we, when we get too gung-ho in technology or in private companies. One is that, as a Nobel Prize winner, Bob Solo, said not too long ago, we see computers everywhere, but not in the productivity numbers. That is to say, skeptics would tell you that, oh yes, of course, we have 140 character communication, but human beings are still failing to communicate with each other or to improve politics or to get along. So the connection between technology and human flourishing is less than obvious. And the other doubt, you know, I'm not a technology skeptic by any means, but I do work in a lot of countries in which private enterprise still remains a bit of a dirty word, especially at a time of, you know, Pandora Papers and Panama Papers and rich people hiding their incomes abroad. It would seem that in order to have a social contract which brings business in, you need business to be, you know, kind of somebody who's accepted at the table. And in some, you know, if you go to Silicon Valley, of course, business is welcome at the table. If you go to lots of other places, you know, business is not a welcome partner at the table. So tell us a bit more. How do we bring both technology and business into this new social contract without people throwing stones at them?
Well, I think first it's reasonable actually to throw stones. You know, I think that they do. I actually think that's a perfectly legitimate point of view. And I'm going to speak since I, you know, for 4 years that I worked at the State Department as a diplomat. I'm not a diplomat anymore, so I'm going to speak. I'm going to speak undiplomatically. Yeah. Let's talk about technology for a second. I mean, I probably know most of the bold-faced boy billionaires from California.
Right.
And you know, spending time with them, I've become utterly convinced that there's a big difference between intelligence and wisdom. Mm-hmm. These are all very smart young men, and they're all young men, yeah, for what it's worth.
Yeah.
I'm 49. That means everybody under 49 is young.
are they mostly male as well?
They're all male. You know, I mean, some of there are a couple at the periphery, but if we're talking about the real protagonists, if we're talking about the people who are both the owners of capital and who are driving the agenda with inside these organizations, they're 99% male. They are intelligent. They have very high IQs, but they are not wise. There are not many stamps in those passports of theirs. Mm-hmm. In fact, I heard that, you know, one of the most prominent investors in the world and, you know, probably the most powerful board member at Facebook, Mark Andreessen. Somebody told me the other day that he doesn't have a passport, that his passport expired 15 years ago and he hasn't renewed it since. I don't know whether that's true, but somebody
Number that is something like 80% of Americans never held a passport or something to that effect?
Something to that effect. And what's interesting, Andres, is that a lot of these guys became very, very wealthy and powerful at very, very young ages.
Right.
So if you're 23, 24, 25 years old, when you are worth hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars, and you suddenly are traveling the world, not from the economy class in the back of the 747 to visit a country, but from a private jet with a phalanx of support staff around you, you don't understand the world. You don't understand it geopolitically. You don't understand it culturally. And so I think that this technology is powerful and important. I do think we live longer and healthier lives for it. There are none of these technologies that I would want to turn off. But I do think that I don't think that we can accept the doctrine that comes from the technology community, because I think we have to recognize the limits of its wisdom. Lots of intelligence, not a lot of wisdom. To the second point about the private sector more broadly, I think that's also a reasonable point. I will say, and this is a sentence not, you know, in many countries people won't say, I'm a capitalist, because I do believe that it is the most effective form of both growing and distributing wealth. Having said that, capitalism isn't all one thing. And I write at some significant length in the book about the distinction between so-called shareholder capitalism, the capitalism as advanced by the University of Chicago School of Economics, versus stakeholder capitalism. And for me, I hate that distinction, shareholder capitalism versus stakeholder capitalism. I think it's more accurate to say short-term capitalism versus long-term capitalism. But I do think it's worth scrutinizing the place of the private sector. Let me just give you sort of one remarkable data point. If the level of inequality in the United States, just in the United States, had stayed at a constant level over the last 40 years, instead of widening to its current Mad Max-like state, it would have meant that $50 trillion, trillion with a T, would have gone to workers earning below the 90th percentile. That is an additional $1,100 every single month for every single worker. Now, I think that $1,100 per worker per month would year after year would create a lot less rage in the world. So I do think, so I am one of those who do believe that we have to repair our capitalism, but we if we exclude the private sector from the conversation, then what we really do is we take one of the most powerful actors and don't use the power that they have in service of some of the social and economic goals that we may have. So I recognize the nuance within all of this, but I also believe that either they are, it's like a Thanksgiving dinner. We're about to have a Thanksgiving holiday here. They're going to be at the dinner. They're either going to be seated at the table or they're going to be the turkeys getting carved up. Yeah. And they should choose to be seating at the table.
Yes. The President of the United States pardons a turkey every year at the White House, but it's probably the only turkey that gets pardoned. Not a good place to be. So let me go back to your title, because rage is typically not a very good thing. Rage can lead people to make very poor choices. And as one looks at the, world political scene today, all the cliches happen to be true: polarized, fragmented, divided, raging. You go on Twitter, of course, and it's nastier than ever. We had a hugely polarized election in the US. We have a more polarized political situation in the UK than that, and that was true for a long time, maybe since Thatcher. I come from Latin America. There are going to be 3 presidential elections in the next 12 months in Latin America, and Chile, Colombia, and Brazil. Looks pretty likely that all 3 elections will feature second rounds between the extreme left and the extreme right. And you could say the same thing about India or Israel or Hungary or Poland or the Philippines. So to bring the private sector in, to give one example, and not the only issue where sanity needs to prevail, you need a dollop of tour serenity and willingness to chat and talk and come to an agreement. But consensus used to be a good word. Consensus in many countries nowadays is kind of a reviled word. So how do we rage and redraw the social contract at the same time? Isn't there a risk we'll simply throw the social contract out the window and then we're left with nothing?
So I think we're close to having thrown the social contract out the window and being left with nothing already. Yeah. This is not universally the case, but it is in the United States, and it's tilting in that direction in the United Kingdom. In a world where, I'll give you some more numbers. I know that everybody says don't use data because it bores people, but I can't help myself.
This is a school of public policy where we take great pride in, designing evidence-based policies. So a little evidence is never bad.
Good. All right. So before I gave some data about the last 40 years, now I'll give some data about the last 30 years. And again, I'll use just the United States as a point of context. Over the last 30 years, so since I was in my second year of university, so obviously not that long ago. That's right. The day before yesterday, the top 1% have grown $21 trillion dollars richer, while the bottom 50% have grown $900 billion poorer, and the middle class is stagnated. This trend is playing out in much of the Western world, while the developing world is watching and taking notes. So I would argue that what that data demonstrates is that the social contract is already ripped. And what we're beginning to now see, whether it's Brexit, whether it is extremist political movements in the United States, Gilets Jaunes in France, Cinque Stelle in Italy, all of these are movements that, while they're all very different, in many, they are rejectionist in many respects. Mm-hmm. They are commonly rejectionist, saying things aren't working. That it's a recognition that whatever contract that existed previously isn't working. So what I do believe is that it's more difficult to convene than ever before. But the necessity for so doing is more necessary than ever before. But this doesn't all have to be done globally, and it doesn't all have to be done nationally. I mean, there are ways of sort of breaking things into smaller units to demonstrate what's possible. Mm-hmm. And you'll make more progress in some areas than in others. But if you think about things like labor rights, what is the role of the long stagnating blue collar laborer, mm-hmm. that ought to be something that could be politically inclusive. But it takes a willingness to be a bit open-minded. I mean, I will say that there are certain words that are banned from the text of the book. The words Trump, Obama, mm-hmm. Boris Johnson, Hillary Clinton, Biden, mm-hmm. Macron, none of these words appear because they're so triggering. Right. And they produce emotional responses that then create intellectual conclusions. And right. I'm guilty of this myself. You say Donald Trump.
Yeah. Anti-intellectual conclusion sometimes.
Smart people become stupid oftentimes as soon as you start talking about this. So I think that part of what we have to do is we sort of have to put our partisan guns down in order to make headway on any of these issues.
Let's stick with the subject of labor rights for a minute. You said at the outset in your intro that you're quite critical of the labor movement in countries like the US, maybe in Western Europe as well, because they've sort of stuck to the past a bit. There's a political difficulty there because unions tend to, you know, agitate or work for the things that they've worked for decades. But there's also, kind of, I don't know what to call it, a structural change. It is very easy to unionize a factory. It is very hard to unionize Uber. And of course, the challenges that are thrown up by the changing nature of work, you know, the gig economy and all of that are gigantic. So if I said, you know, Alec, here's the FAL-CIO and you want to give him counsel on what a union should look like in the, you know, past the raging 2020s, what is a modern union movement in the US or in the UK or in Europe to do to sort of embrace change, but at the same time, you know, do things differently than they did in the past century?
Yeah. So one of the people who I interviewed a fair bit for this book was the president of the AFL-CIO, who actually died a few weeks before the book published, which is, it was interesting to hear.
Not out of shock from the things that you were saying, I hope.
No, he didn't get to read the book. But it was interesting to hear his reflections and the sort of the failures that he owned up to, as well as those things that sort of got him to clench his fists a little bit about and say, no, gosh darn it, you guys got it wrong on that. I mean, what I would say two things. I would say, first of all, in the same way in which we have startups that become big companies, I think that we do need, in effect, startups in the world of unions. America's biggest and most powerful companies quite often are, you know, less than 40 years old. And a lot of our biggest companies, oldest companies, oftentimes, like the older unions, they grow stagnant. Yesterday, GE, General Electric, announced that it was going to split into three different companies. Right. The IBMs and the GEs, which are the AFL-CIOs, they are the large old unions, they aren't the most agile. So part of what I believe we need to have is we need to actually have entrepreneurship in the labor movement. It's not all about changing these large organizations. That said, to go back to your question
can I just stop you there? Because let me just play devil's advocate here for a minute. The analogy between a company and a union is appealing, but maybe flawed in at least two dimensions. One is that, you know, in for unions, scale matters, you know, so little unions don't really have a lot of bargaining power with employers. But also, you know, if we had someone from the union movement participating in this conversation, he or she would probably say unions are not simply about money. They're about tradition, culture, identity. You know, if you've worked in the auto industry in Detroit and so did your parents and your grandparents, there's a lot more to belonging to the auto workers union than simply getting a pay raise. You know, there's probably a whole culture that you're a part of. So wouldn't you be losing some of that if you break them up or if you start little, you know, unions which are not tributary or sort of, you know, have the legacy of that culture?
I think break them up. I mean, you see tradition and culture, it's a culture
I can certainly see you're not a diplomat anymore.
No, I mean, look, it's a tradition that doesn't work anymore. And, you know, there aren't very many third and fourth generation auto workers in Detroit anymore. You want to know why? Because they went to Alabama, you know? And the reason why there aren't any new generation auto workers in Michigan is because their parents and their parents' union failed. So, and also if we're to talk about the culture, and look, I'm from the coal-filled hills of West Virginia, and I worked shoulder to shoulder with Teamsters, you know, on the beer truck. This is the world and the culture that I come from. I don't think that we should deify right now the culture of the unions, because at least in the United States, they tend to be, they are almost exclusively white and male, certainly and overwhelmingly in terms of their composition and always in terms of their leadership, even though their membership is growing in terms of the numbers of women and minorities, not as a percentage of the membership. It's right. Always a certain type of white guy right. who runs it. Also, the unions are becoming increasingly politically reactionary in their own respect. So what's interesting is that union members for the first time in 2016 voted for Donald Trump more. They voted for the Republican for president more so than they voted for the Democrat. So they have sort of separated economic interest mm-hmm. from cultural affinity. So the cultural affinity tends to be, you know, the macho right-wing Republican now, and that prevails over the economic interest. And so I think that one of the best things for the union movement would be the destruction of something.
Just to play devil's advocate again, could that not simply be the result of a Democratic Party which before Biden became too enamored of the causes of the liberal elites on the East and West Coast and forgot a little bit about the working man or working woman?
That is absolutely a part of it. And I acknowledge that. And I quote the president of the AFL-CIO to that. But simultaneously, the problems with labor date back in the US and in the UK date back to the late 1970s and 1980s. You know, Thatcher and Reagan really broke the spines of a lot of these unions, and they never recovered since. And unfortunately, what a lot of them did is they went into a defensive posture. It was all defense, no offense. It's we're going to protect what we have rather than try to grow. And then there's the added problem of corruption. So you brought up the United Auto Workers. Two consecutive presidents of the United Auto Workers just went to jail. So unfortunately, the cultural dimensions of these unions have also all too often lent themselves to criminal or near criminal behavior. And this is true, for example, in Italy, where many of the unions are you know, heavily integrated with the mafia. It's true in France, where there's a sort of class within the unions where of no-show workers who are getting paid 2 and 3x what the union members are, you know, as a product of the dues. So no, I hate the word disruption. It's overused, but I do think that the labor movement could use from some new ideas. It could use from some new actors. It could use for some new institutions. It could use for some disruption.
One last question on labor before we move on. And by the way, for people joining this this Zoom call, please, you know, feel free to send in questions. I certainly have plenty of questions that I can that I'm very happy to be asking Alec. But if anybody would like to come in, please don't be shy. At these LSE events, people are very seldom shy. So before we leave the subject matter of labor rights, you said also in your intro, and you say in the book as well, that it is very unlikely that any one of your three kids will work more than a few years for a company before moving on. In that world in which either people work gigs without a contract, or even if they have a contract, you know, my boss, Minou Shafiq, who also wrote a book about the social contract recently, is fond of quoting the fact that the average CV on LinkedIn has 8 jobs. So people who are in their, you know, 30s or 40s have worked for 7, 8, 9, 10 employers already. How do you run a labor movement, or what kinds of services, you know, what, you know, you've been critical of the old labor movement. So these innovators, what kinds of services, security, job protection, income protection, ought a modern labor movement in a modern workplace, which is so volatile, provide?
Yeah, so first I think we have to recognize that a modern labor movement probably should be trying to steward the interests of people who don't have LinkedIn profiles. And so unfortunately, you know, there's that, the mobility that Manoush was describing is of knowledge workers, and knowledge workers certainly do need labor protections. But I think we also need to remember that the people who go to work with either a blue collar or no collar on their shirt and have no LinkedIn profile, but they still, here's the point, that the premise of your question, I still believe to be accurate. They still have that same level of mobility. Those are actually the trickier ones. Those are actually the trickier ones. And so in this case, I think that, I mean, first of all, I think that we need to go from more organizing being employer-based. You know, as you correctly pointed out, Andres, it's a lot easier to organize on the factory floor than it is to organize over a platform. Sure. But if we look at the results of labor, where I think it's worked much more effectively, particularly in Central and Northern Europe, they tend to organize sectorally versus employer-based. So that, I think, first of all, gives some scale in negotiations that I think is important. The second thing I think that they ought to be doing is increasingly advocating for a role in governance. So, you know, there's, of course, the German model where if you have above a certain number of employees, you have to have employee representation on the board of directors. There are lots of different variations on this that I won't go into, but what I will say is the hard distinction between capital and labor, the hard distinction between the shareholders and the workers tends not to work out very well over the long term for the workers. If there isn't representation by the workers in the boardrooms, if the workers are not benefiting from equity as well. You know, one of the, I've been very critical of Silicon Valley during our discussion, but one thing I think Silicon Valley did do well, which I think much of the rest of the world can learn from and non-technology based sectors can learn from, is employee ownership. So in a world where, I mean, Andres, you know this better than anybody, our well-being appreciates not so much as a function of the increase of our wages, but of the increased value of our assets, enabling more people to become owners of assets, meaning have some ownership stake in the companies where they work, I think would be extremely beneficial as well. So when I think about a labor movement for the 2020s and beyond, part of what I think needs to go onto the bargaining table are increasingly are issues around governance and equity. Equity defined as some piece of the company.
Some piece of the pie.
That's right.
So let's talk about democracy a little bit. You have a chapter on government, which is, you know, which begins in one of the subsections with a memorable statement. You say, democracy, representative democracy, is inefficient by design. And I can see what you mean, because when there are lots of checks and balances, by definition, things take a long time. And that we typically view as a strength of democracy. But another trend in the modern world is that not only is there increasing citizen dissatisfaction and unrest when it comes to the role of business or inequality or volatility of incomes, also in the US, in the UK, and in many other democracies, both consolidated and not consolidated, when you look at survey data, you ask, you know, is democracy performing? Is it delivering for you? You know, are you pleased with democracy? Would you consider some other form of government for your country? Those answers are very, very dispiriting, right? Even in hugely consolidated like the US and the UK, and those consolidated democracies, people are very, very skeptical. And the younger the interviewee, the more skeptical that person is likely to be. So could it, you know, you've been in Italy, you know, the great political scientist Norberto Bobbio wrote at length about this, and he talked about the unkept promises of democracy. And those unkept promises are particularly unkept precisely at a time when things move very quickly, when everybody's raging, when we want, I can go on Amazon or Ocado and have something, you know, be delivered at my doorstep in a couple of hours, whereas if I ask something of the government, it's going to take 2 years, right? So there would seem to be, you know, the tension that you describe in the book, as you also point out in the book, has become more intense and more extreme and more difficult to deal with. So that social contract, how do we address that growing tension?
So this is part of the, I read about this in saying some of what we need to do with in government. So first of all, you're absolutely right. And one of the things that we see, and this was true in the this was true after the revolutions of the 1840s, and it's true now, is that part of what people want in an environment of stagnation or an environment where you can't get things done from government, people do tend to want the strong man. Strong men become increasingly attractive. So there was a wave of authoritarians that took root in Europe in the mid 19th century. And if you think now about the world, people at times often point to Putin and Trump, but there are a lot of them. There's Bolsonaro, there's Duterte, there's Erdogan, you know, all of whom were democratically elected, I point out. So the idea of the strong man, and I use the word man purposefully because it is inevitably a very sort of macho, broad-shouldered, I'm going to take over and I'm going to make things happen. And the rhetoric across, you know, from Trump to Bolsonaro to Erdogan to Duterte to, you know, there are common strings between them. And it stresses the ability of representative democracies to get done what they need to get done. So part of what I do believe we need increasingly in government is we need to build the capacity within government to actually execute against the aspirations of citizens. So, you know, I point to a few things that are particularly problematic in the UK and in the USA. And one thing is brain drain. Mm-hmm. So from World War II through the Cold War, if you graduated from the London School of Economics or from Harvard or from Princeton, or you were one of these high-flying young people beginning your career, there was no place more attractive for you to go work. If you had a strong background in economics, you go work at your Treasury Department. If you had a strong background in political science and the humanities, go to work for the Foreign Office. Now it's go to work for Google or McKinsey or Goldman Sachs. Right. So we've seen this huge push of our human capital from what would have been in the public sector into the private sector. And too often, those of us who do work in government, you know, we will be appointed, we'll be in it for 4 or 5 years, and then we'll leave. Right. And part of how we can remedy this, I think, is through the increased professionalization of government service. You know, I find it annoying when the Daily Mail or others sort of rail against the very high salaries of people working in government. And it might be £70,000 a year, £80,000 a year, and they've got their fists clenched and they're calling them fat cats and other such things without recognizing that any of these people could go and make 30% more the next day.
Or three times more, actually.
Or three times more.
Yeah.
And so I do believe that the countries, and I point to Singapore, and Singapore is lots of people's favorite examples of lots of things because it's a very small country. Yeah. But I do think that we can further professionalize government by raising pay, by putting more worker protections in place, by raising the dignity of public service so that more people will choose to work in government and to do so for longer. But the long-serving 25-year civil servant who's working for substantially less than what she or he could otherwise get, who is not going to take a single risk because if they do so, they get their heads blown off. Right. These are the people tasked with delivering services, and they're not going to do so, therefore, with the speed of Amazon.
Yeah. No, you put your finger on something that we think about a lot. You know, we're a school of public policy. We have a degree that is bespoke, as they like to say in the UK, for the UK civil service. We have an EMPP. We train 30 or 40 of the high flyers in the civil service a year. And they're very, very, very high quality people. But once you recognize how crucial the role happens to be, which it is, other sorts of issues arise. Pay is one, job security is another. In the UK, the current debate, I think it's fascinating, and I'm not sure where I land on this, is you know, the model of the traditional Westminster civil service in Canada, Australia, New Zealand are a bit like this, is everybody's a generalist. you know, in university, you do history or English or PPE, politics, philosophy, and economics, and then you spend 2 years at the Treasury, but then you go off to health and then go off to agriculture. And many people are very critical of this model because you know a little bit of everything, but you don't really, you know, are an expert in anything. And today, you know this better than anybody else, Alec. If you're going to be in, say, regulating securities, or if you're going to be in cybersecurity, you need a lot of very technical knowledge, right? So maybe we need two models of civil servant, the generalist who will be taking sort of political or general policy decisions, and then the expert. And it's not clear how you put together a civil service, whether in the UK or any place else, which makes room for these two career paths and these two types of people.
Yeah, and I'll say I don't have a religious view on this either. It's very tricky because on the one hand, I do believe that people who are the generalists are able to bring an interdisciplinary approach to governing that I think is very important. But I do think we have to create space for the experts. I mean, it is a serious, I mean, again, you pointed to the problem in the UK, in the other government systems I know best, including the United States, the relative gap of expertise in, say, cybersecurity is a huge problem. You know, part of what I was tasked to do by President Obama was bring an understanding of technology into a foreign policy establishment that didn't really understand it. Technology was just used as, you know, from the standpoint of developing either weapons or intercept systems. Right. You know, we're going to intercept your communications or we're going to kill you. You know, and then we're really good at developing technologies for these two things, but the other stuff is quite difficult. So I agree that you've got your thumb on a key issue there.
That's a difficult question, yes. And parenthetically, I will say I did not appreciate the fact that you mentioned Harvard and Princeton and neglected my alma mater, Yale. a completely unacceptable omission, if I may point that out. But on the spirit of the times, and then, you know, I'm going to turn to questions from the chat. You begin the book with an anecdote that I found was very revealing, and you know, you can provide the details yourself, but which has to do with the perception that life in prosperous countries like the US is no longer as peaceful and as secure as it was. And not only do we fear political polarization, but we fear all kinds of violence that we thought maybe had been driven away from highly educated, prosperous societies. You know, there's a sense of tension in the air, which of course the likes of, you know, Trump and Duterte and Erdogan and you know, Bolsonaro do nothing to alleviate, on the contrary. I know that policy alone is not going to be an easy kind of cure for this kind of disease. It's a deeper cultural disease, if you want to put it that way. But if you had to point to one thing that should change or can change to alleviate that growing sense of insecurity, what would that be?
I think that, let's go to actually social media. I think that the effect of social media on radicalization can't be understated. Just yesterday, a member of the United States Congress retweeted a video that showed him killing his colleague, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, AOC, and attacking the President of the United States. This would have been inconceivable 10 years ago. Yeah. Inconceivable. I mean, just who would do that? And now it's just another afternoon's news. I mean, so the weaponization of the information space where we are now propagandizing about killing. These were the policies. This is what the Taliban did. Mm-hmm. The Taliban, I mean, literally, I mean, the Taliban would put videos up that would show, you know, even in cartoon form, that would mainstream the concept of an act of violence as something politically and in their case, spiritually fulfilling. This is what's happening in the United States right now. So the question for me is, if social media is playing such a deeply radicalizing role, what do we do about it? So, and this is one of those things that I think we are past the point of litigating whether it is or not. I think we're already seeing the force and effect of it. The question now is, what is the intervention? And it's something that ought to unite the political right and political left. The problem right now is that in the United States, if there were a bill introduced in the Senate that said, be it resolved that the sun will rise in the east and set in the west, it would end up as a 50-50 vote.
Sure.
So the question is, in a deeply polarized environment, can the right and the left, who both agree that social media is increasingly toxic and problematic, can they do anything of a statutory or regulatory nature to respond? But I would start there, Andres. So if you want to talk about what is different today than was different 10 years ago, and what has really boiled the kettle, if the economics dynamics have only continued, but the dynamics were already in place 10 years ago.
So let us stay with this for a minute, because you said we need to move to the answers, which is of course right. Give us a little bit more of a flavor of, you know, if you had the pen and you could write that bill, what kinds of interventions do you think are most suited? This is a really hard question. I get asked this question all the time, and I often punt because I'm not quite sure what the answer is, but I'm sure you will have better points to make than I will.
Well, I don't know, but here's one thing I would say is I think in many respects we should mirror the regulations that exist in the real world with the online world. So if saying something, if doing something, if a given action, if action X is illegal in the real world, then its digital twin should be as well. I think a mirroring, both from a rights standpoint, but in terms of our rights and in terms of our responsibilities, I think the rights we have, the freedoms that we have, ought to manifest themselves online. But I also think the responsibilities and the culpabilities that we have in the quote unquote real world ought to extend online.
Can we do that in practice, though? I can sue the New York Times for slander, but you know, suing a Russian bot for slander is a little bit more difficult.
No, it is. And the question then becomes, though, here's the tricky bit. If the Russian bot, isn't what changes minds. The Russian bot amplifies a view of some real world person made famous, perhaps in part by millions of bots that are amplifying his or her point of view. Right. So it's the neo-Nazi in Florida amplified by the bot. Yes, we have to fight against the bots, right, but it's the neo-Nazi in Florida who ultimately has to be held accountable.
Hope we can manage that. Let me turn to a question by Rebecca Gardner. I think she makes a very important point, because we've been talking as though the pandemic hadn't happened, which is a bit of a relief sometimes. We've talked about COVID so much. But Rebecca asks, how has the pandemic affected this new social contract? And if so, what aspects have been changed most?
So it's accelerated. It's funny. So I started writing the book before the pandemic.
But then lockdown came and you became very prolific, I'm sure.
And then I had no excuse for not delivering my manuscript on time.
Right, right.
It's absolutely true. And what the pandemic did is it accelerated everything. You know, if you think, for example, about artificial intelligence, machine learning and robotics, digitization, we saw 5 years of investment in artificial intelligence and robotics that were 5 years of what we thought we were going to be investments taking place in about two years, going on 2.5 years. We saw trends economically in terms of inequality becoming wildly accelerated. So the dynamic that existed pre-pandemic, it just accelerated all the more. I mean, this is, again, I'll be undiplomatic for a moment. And, you know, having gone from working on a beer truck in the coal-filled hills of West Virginia to now living and working in the world of capital, it's bizarre to me that the year of the pandemic, you know, the past 2 years have been the two best years economically for my family ever. Sure. And it's because of the acceleration that took place in the distinction between capital and labor. So if I were back working on the beer truck, it would have been the worst 2 years economically ever. Absolutely. But because my well-being is a function of the appreciation of assets, it was better than ever. So with the pandemic,
you and I could work from home safely.
Exactly.
Zoom. People who work in a pizzeria can't do that.
That's right. I mean, if you, it's the difference between the world of bits and bytes and the world of atoms. What the pandemic did is it gave greater wealth, financial wealth, to people who lived and worked in the world of bits and bytes. And it made life much more difficult for people that lived and worked in the world of atoms.
Right. So we only have a couple minutes left, and maybe let me ask you one last question that might bring it all together, I hope, but also give you a chance to add anything that you think we should have mentioned and haven't. There are two kinds of crises: those that bring societies together after all the suffering, and those that tear societies apart. You know, while you were writing your book in lockdown, one thing that I did is, as somebody who moved to the UK 2 or 3 years ago, but I've always been very, very interested in British history, began reading books about the last time London was locked down. And that was, of course, 1940, when the Nazis were raining bombs on this lovely city. And one thing you learn about that very traumatic and painful experience is that after the war, the UK, of course, was impoverished. It was lamenting the death of tens of thousands of people. But as a society, it came together. You know, the rich kid from Oxford and the poor kid from the mines in the north of England had been in the same trench or fighting the same battalion in Belgium or in Germany. So there was a shared sense of purpose. By contrast, for instance, if we think about the world financial crisis 10 years ago that you and I were involved in, you know, you don't have to say this, I'll say this. I think the Obama administration handled it very well from an economic and technical point of view, and so did Gordon Brown in the UK. That's my judgment as an economist. As a citizen, of course, the perception, and this is hard to deny, was that Wall Street was bailed out, that that Main Street got the end, you know, short end of a stick. So this crisis has made us rage. But on the other hand, you think that the way to put an end to that rage is to get people to sit around the table and agree on a contract. Can we do those two things at once? Or to go back to my analogy, will this be 1945 when we know we've suffered and come together after the crisis? Or will it be 2010 in which we suffer and then we keep fighting?
I think it depends on entirely which country you're in. There are 196 countries on planet Earth, and I think that there are going to be 196 different responses to this. So I think in certain countries, you will see, I think what the pandemic will do is accelerate division. But I think that that is actually the minority example. I think in most states and societies, what we've seen is for all the suffering. You know, as Picasso said, every act of creation begins with an act of destruction. I actually think that we're seeing some binding together of people that didn't exist previously. So in this case, I think that it's an open question in the United States, but I think unfortunately we're going to come out of this more divided than ever because we politicized things like vaccination. Right. We politicized mask wearing. Right. But I think that in much of the rest of the world, throughout much of East Asia, I think they're going to come out of this more unified than previously. I think for much of Europe, they're going to come out of this more unified than previously. Sometimes that will manifest itself politically, sometimes it won't. But in terms of identity, in terms of citizenship, in terms of whether you're going to say the level of rage is increasing or decreasing, I think that unfortunately the United States is an outlier in this respect, where we're really coming out of this more divided, more angry, and more at each other's throats than going in. You know, I spent most of the pandemic living in Italy.
Right.
And Italy has really come together. I mean, Italy is a country that is usually the caricature of dysfunction.
Right.
And it's a many respects the caricature of division. And I think there's no question that it is a much more unified country and frankly a better governed country today, coming through this experience than it was going into it.
With a central banker as prime minister.
That's right.
Something that makes economists happy. I'm not sure it makes everybody else happy, but
it's making Italians happy right now.
Yes, he's doing a very, very good job. Okay, so again, the raging 2020s, and we're very, very thankful to Alec for joining us. And I will end reminding people who joined us today that the book can be had through Pages of Hackney, who is the bookseller in the UK associated with LSE events. But of course, I'm sure you can also get it from other sellers. I will not mention any so that we do not take any business away from Pages of Hackney, but it is readily available. It is a great book. And I've enjoyed this conversation hugely. I hope you have too. Thank you, Alec. Hope you will join us again at an LSE event. And for those of you who have joined today, and for those of you who will be tuning in and listening to this conversation later, thank you very much. And I hope to see you all soon at another LSE School of Public Policy event. Good evening. Bye, Alec. Bye-bye, everyone.
Thank you very much.
Pleasure.